This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right about this time of year, Wisconsin's monarch butterflies are in central Mexico's mountain forests. That's their winter habitat, where they rest and reproduce before they make their way back to the state in the spring. But even though they're down south for the next few months, our next guest says we can prepare for their return trip right now. Caitlin Williamson is the Director of Conservation Programs at the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. She also does communications and outreach for the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative. That's this new statewide coalition focused on restoring the state's monarch population. Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we'll get into the why and the importance of restoring habitat. I'm having a hard time getting my head around that we can do stuff outside in the winter. What kind of things could we be doing right now to help out monarchs?
Well, it's a great time, actually. So in Wisconsin, native milkweed and other native plant seeds actually require a prolonged period of cold before they germinate and grow. So kind of these late fall months before we get a big snowfall is a great time to do it. Either planting some of those native plant seeds directly onto the soil right now, if you don't have a huge snowfall in your area of the state, or even with an inch or two of snow is a great time so that the plants are able to properly germinate and then grow.
I had no idea you could plant these in the winter. And can you go out and buy these milkweed seeds?
Absolutely. And our new website for the Monarch Collaborative, wimonarchs.org, has a whole list of resources, including local native plant nurseries where you can find milkweed and other native plants to buy.
I've got a lot of milkweed in my yard, and I got to say, I'm not like a botanical genius. There were some growing, and I just, made sure I didn't pull them out, and now they're spreading, and that's great. These are plants that are, once they get going, they're pretty easy to maintain, right?
That is true. Yeah, native plants tend to be like that. They don't require a lot of maintenance, and, luckily for all the wildlife and monarchs and other pollinators that benefit, they spread pretty quickly.
And in addition to planting, we can also do some planning, right? In addition to the milkweed, what else? That's what they need for their caterpillars. What other stuff can we plant to help in terms of nectar for the grown-ups?
Yeah, absolutely. So like you said, Rob, the monarch larvae require milkweed, so it's their host plant. But adult monarchs require a whole slew of native nectar plants to really feed. And so any kind of native plants that you can buy, especially the nectaring ones like we're talking about, are really great. The website that we have, wimonarchs.org, has a list of resources, including even a top 12 species list for folks who kind of want a primer on some of the top species that would attract monarchs. Those include plants like goldenrods, black-eyed Susans, coneflowers, blazing stars. There's a whole list. And it really, the focus is on having those native plants because they just do a world of good for monarchs and other pollinators.
Now, we've talked about the Monarch Collaborative a little bit, and one key point that people were making is we're talking to you, even if you don't have vast tracts of farm and forest land, you can make a difference with just a little patch, right?
That is true. I think that's one of the most unique or special things about this conservation initiative with the Monarch is that really everyone can make a difference. It's really all hands on deck approach. Whether you have you're in Madison or Milwaukee and have a small urban backyard, or you have a back 40 or working lands, any stems of milkweed and native plants that you can plant will really make a difference.
Let's spend a couple minutes on why now. Talk about the state of the monarch butterfly migration and habitat available for them.
Sure. So the monarch population has experienced a really rapid and significant decline. So the populations have declined by nearly 90% in just a couple of decades. It's been really quite bad for the monarchs, and the leading cause of that is the loss of their habitat, so that native milkweed and other native plants that they really utilize. And so right now, the Fish and Wildlife Service is actually considering whether or not to list the monarch as a federally protected species under the Endangered Species Act. That decision is expected to come in June of next year. But regardless of that, folks here in Wisconsin and across the U.S. are really wanting to make a difference and help reverse that trend because, of course, monarchs are so well recognized. Most people have seen monarchs, in their own backyard and want that experience for their kids and into the future. And what's great about monarchs, too, is that when you plant milkweed or other native plants, you're benefiting not just the monarch, but tons of other pollinators and insect species, bird species even. So it's just a really great kind of all-around great conservation project across the state.
And you've got some resources via the Monarch Collaborative. Where can people find that, and what kind of things can they find online, for example?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative website just launched last week. That website is wimonarchs.org. And the collaborative is a group of more than 40 different organizations who've come together across Wisconsin, federal and state agencies, nonprofit organizations, businesses, organizations who really just want to come together and make a difference. And our goal with the website was really just to kind of synthesize all the resources available that are out there for monarchs and making it kind of Wisconsin-specific. And so we have specific Create Habitat section on the website, which has specific guidelines for agricultural lands, for urban spaces, private and protected lands, rights of way like highway corridors, all sorts of different kind of sector-specific resources. So there's a lot if you want to get started and creating habitat for monarchs. We also have a pledge you can take to show your support for monarch conservation in Wisconsin and a way to donate to support Wisconsin monarch conservation efforts as well.
And that URL again before we let you go, Caitlin?
WIMonarchs.org.
WIMonarchs.org. Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Caitlin Williamson with the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative with us to talk about ways we can start adding back habitat for monarch butterflies right now, even in the winter, before they head back to the state this spring.
Tell it on the mountain, over the hills and everywhere.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're hearing Gordon McRae singing Go Tell It on the Mountain from an album of Christmas favorites released in 1964 by the Firestone Tire Company. In the 1960s, Firestone was one of many companies putting out holiday records as a promotional item. This weekend, WRST in Oshkosh is airing a holiday special featuring songs from those albums. They're calling the show White Wall Christmas. It airs this Saturday at 1 o'clock and Sunday at 3. It'll stream at WRST.org. Andrew Smock is the chair of the Department of Radio, TV, and Film at UW Oshkosh and had the idea for White Wall Christmas. Andy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, as I understand it, a lot of this is coming from your personal collection. How did you get into collecting Tire Company and other companies' Christmas albums from the 60s?
It is kind of an odd collection to have, isn't it? It actually started with an album that's been in my family since I was a kid. We had the Firestone Volume 6, the Blue Album. For people that are familiar with these albums, they often just call them by the color. We had Volume 6, and I remember as a kid asking my parents, you know, where'd this record come from? And being told that, oh, they used to give them away when you'd buy tires around the Christmas season. And, you know, for years, digging through the thrift store bins of records, I would see other similar ones and never really thought much of it. And then a year or two ago, I got a lot more interested in it and started picking them up. And before I knew it, I had a full collection of all the Firestone albums. And several of the Goodyear albums, but there are more of those that are still on my list to find.
So those are both tire companies, and then some other businesses started getting into the game, right?
Yeah. The list really started to grow pretty quickly. So Goodyear kind of got into the game first. A guy named Stanley Arnold, who had worked for Young & Rubicam for several years, then kind of struck it on his own, went to Goodyear and said, hey, you know what you need is a holiday Christmas album. And they thought he was nuts at first, but he talked him into it. And in 1960, that first album came out. And in 61, Firestone got their first album out. And yet, it wasn't too long after that companies like JCPenney, True Value Hardware, Grant's Department Stores, even Kentucky Fried Chicken, they started coming out with holiday albums. And they all really kind of varied in terms of their approach to the album and how they were going to build it.
Right, yeah, I was going to ask about that. Are these mostly original recordings that they pulled together, or are they just buying the rights to stuff that was already out there?
Well, a lot of them were put together with the aid of, the Columbia Special Products Division inside of Columbia Records. That's actually the group that helped to put together the Goodyear albums. And when they started out, they were all coming from their catalog of recording artists that they had at Columbia. But I think, and this is a little bit of speculation on my part, I've had a hard time kind of finding some primary sources here, but it seems to be that they began adding original recordings in response to what Firestone was doing. And Firestone was always doing all original recordings from day one with their albums. So these were recordings you couldn't get anywhere else, something that you'd never really heard before. And so it seems like Goodyear was trying to kind of keep up to a degree with Firestone by beginning to offer some original recordings. And there were some pretty pretty unique ones that came about through that process.
Like what?
Well, one that really kind of jumps to mind was on the it was the fifth album that Goodyear did, and they had, you know, several performers on here as they normally did, but on this album, about half of the songs are originally recorded for the album. But the one that's of most interest to me is one that was commissioned and written for the album to be sung by Sammy Davis Jr. And it's a song I think a lot of folks in the listening audience would probably be familiar with. It's called It's Christmas Time All Over the World. And it was written by Hugh Martin, who also wrote Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, the Trolley Song, Meet Me in St. Louis, and a whole bunch of other songs. But they commissioned him to write that song especially for this album, and it went on to be featured on other collections of Christmas albums for other stores. JCPenney actually had that same track on an album in 1972 that they were giving away at the cash registers. I shouldn't say giving away, they were selling it for a dollar. But that's one that really kind of pops to mind as being really unique. They went out and found this big-name songwriter. They had him write a song especially for them. And that gave them something special on that album.
And these, the Firestone ones in particular, I understand, were hot commodities. People really ate these up.
Yeah, and that was a big surprise to, I think, Goodyear and Firestone. And in particular, Goodyear, in the first year, they really under-ordered the number of albums they had pressed. And into the, I think it was the first week of December, all of the Goodyear outlets were already sold out. They didn't have any more records. And the next year they ordered more, and again they sold out quickly. And I think because it was so novel at the time, that really helped to drive the sale of the albums. As we look kind of later into the 1960s and the market's a little bit more saturated, a lot of the data showed that they weren't selling quite as well, but there still seemed to be a soft spot, especially for the Goodyear and Firestone albums with a lot of folks.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Andy, you'll be spinning some of these tracks that are for our friends at WRST, and are you going to share some more of the history there as well?
Yeah, yep. So between songs, I'm going to offer a little bit more history on the albums, on particular tracks, and just try to give people a sense of where these came from. But I'm really going to focus in on those songs that were originally recorded for those albums that in many cases never made it to CD. So these aren't songs you can really find a lot of places, with the exception of some, like the Sammy Davis Jr. But those that were recorded for Firestone really didn't ever make that leap to CD. So I think that's another thing that makes these very unique.
Well, who knew? Andy, thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks. I appreciate it, Rob.
That's Andrew Smock, chair of the Department of Radio, TV, and Film at UW Oshkosh, with us to talk about the White Wall Christmas special airing on WRST this weekend and online at WRST.org, 1 o'clock on Saturday and at 3 on Sunday. Coming up after the news, the EPA plans to lift emission rules for new coal power plants. We'll talk about how that might change the coal industry if it could reverse its decline over the last decade. Remember, you can support all these conversations right now with your gift in our year-end membership drive. Last day of that drive, give now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The Environmental Protection Agency announced last week that it plans to lift emission restrictions for any new coal-fired power plants. The move would reverse emission standards for new plants put in place by the Obama administration in 2015. The coal industry says that those regulations were so cost-prohibitive that they made new plants impractical to build. But the demand for coal-generated electricity has fallen steadily over the last 10 years as natural gas and renewable energies are getting cheaper and more popular. Harrison Fell is an associate professor in the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics at North Carolina State University. He specializes in the energy market and energy policy. Harrison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the overall energy market picture and competition from natural gas, let's focus in on these regulations. How big a deal, how big a difference did they make for new coal power plant construction?
Well, I think the coal sector is correct in that the previous regulations did make it prohibitively expensive to build that. That said, though, The market conditions that's really preventing a lot of new coal capacity from coming online, namely the low natural gas prices and increased generation from renewables, that's still present. And that's really the driving force behind the both decline of existing coal-fired generation and the major roadblock to building any new coal-fired generation.
Yeah, this is a huge change because it used to be that coal was the cheap fuel source. So if you take out the externalities and the pollution and things like that, just the sheer cost of fuel, coal for a long time was by far, right, our cheapest option for electricity.
That's right, yeah. Historically, coal-fired, the marginal cost of generation from coal-fired generation has been quite a bit below that of natural gas. Nuclear, of course, has been lower and hydro lower than coal, but as we would say in econ, it's typically an inframarginal, meaning not the most expensive generator generating power historically. Now, that, of course, is changing with the fall of natural gas prices.
Yeah, what has happened to drive that fall in natural gas prices?
Yeah, in a word, it's fracking, right? We're sitting on a massive reserves of shale gas in this country, and the improved technology behind hydraulic fracturing has allowed producers to get that gas, and that has made the U.S. market awash in gas. And since you can't really internationally trade gas, basically liquefying it and shipping it is very expensive, and we have limited terminals to do that, we basically sit on all that supply, and that's depressed the price of gas quite a bit.
Now, part of the story on these regulations on coal, on new coal power plants, has to do with carbon emissions, climate change causing emissions. How did natural gas and coal, as we use it today, stack up when it comes to those emissions?
So in terms of electricity generation alone, the emissions intensity of coal-fired plants is about double on average what it is of natural gas plants. So a typical coal plant generates somewhere in the neighborhood of a ton of carbon per megawatt hour of generation, where a gas plant's more around a half a ton per megawatt hour generation.
So that's a pretty huge difference.
Yeah, it's a massive difference, and that's really what's driving the big decline in carbon emissions in the electricity sector that we've seen over the last decade, that switch from coal to gas generation.
Now, looking at the regulations passed in basically the last year or so of the Obama administration, when it comes to trying to stop all that coal coming out of these coal power, or all that carbon coming out of these coal-powered power plants, would that, expenses side, would that have put coal on a par with natural gas when it comes to carbon emissions?
Well, so I think a lot of the Obama-era regulations weren't so much focused on cleaning up the coal that exists. A lot of them would have probably just further pushed us of a switch from coal to gas. I think it probably basically would have put more of these coal plants, reduced their generation, and if not, forced some more retirement. Now, we're still seeing a lot of retirements in the coal generation fleet. I mean, in fact, 2018 is on pace to be our second biggest level of retirements we've seen. Clearly, the repeal and reversal of a lot of Obama-era administration policies is favorable to coal generators.
Talking to Harrison Fell from North Carolina State University, looking at an EPA announcement that they're looking at taking away some Obama-era regulations on new coal power plants, ones that the industry says adds a lot of expense to building new coal power plants. The goal, moving away from coal and or reducing carbon emissions from coal. So, Harrison, absent these regulations, taking them off the table, does that mean that people are going to start building new coal power plants?
I can't imagine that we're going to see a massive increase in coal-fired generation, if any at all. Again, the market forces that are really hurting coal-fired generation are low natural gas prices and increased renewable generation. And the low natural gas prices are likely to be here for the foreseeable future. And with falling cost of renewable generation, it's also and likely that we're going to continue to see increased generation from renewable generation sources, wind and solar. So those two market conditions really make it not a favorable environment for coal-fired generators, both existing and certainly make it really unlikely that you'd want to build a new one.
A lot of the interest in getting rid of these regulations has to do with maybe a political drive to keep jobs in the coal mining industry in places like Kentucky, in regions of Appalachia and elsewhere. Is that going to happen? Are we going to see coal mining jobs stick around in the foreseeable future?
Well, we've certainly seen a massive decline in those, and that's driven largely, but not exclusively, but largely by declines in generation from coal-fired power plants, which of course reduces the demand for coal domestically. And so the fact that we are unlikely to be able to revive the coal-fired generation due to the low natural gas prices and increased renewables means I think it's probably very unlikely we're going to stave off further declines in the coal mining industry as well.
Now, as I understand it, we here in Wisconsin are a pretty coal-heavy state, right, when it comes to electricity generation. Are you seeing this turnover from coal to natural gas and renewables, even in a state like Wisconsin?
Yeah, it is happening nationally. The Midwest, Wisconsin included, does tend to be more coal-heavy, but there's been some major pledges by Wisconsin utilities to cut carbon and increase renewables, and we've seen some closures of some major plants, the Pleasant Prairie coal-fired power plants, a 1.2 gigawatt plant is scheduled to be closed down, and so. This is not a phenomenon that's completely localized. We're seeing it pretty nationally, this move from coal to gas or to renewable sources.
So if I were a politician and I said it's important to me because of my region, whatever, to keep the coal industry alive, would it take subsidies, massive subsidies? Is there a realistic alternative for someone like President Trump who says he's going to bring coal back?
Yeah, I think if your goal is to revive and keep the coal industry going, you're either going to have to massively subsidize coal-fired generation or make it much more expensive to get gas-fired generation and renewable generation. And the only way you could really do that is, I don't know, ban fracking or something like that, which seems, you know, completely implausible under this administration or really, really any other administration. So it would seem like you would have to go after some big subsidies, and they are, of course, talking about that. There has been some plans floated by FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to basically cover the cost of coal-fired generators to keep them going.
Looking longer term, 10, 20 years down the road, what kind of trends are you watching for in electricity production in the United States?
Yeah, so again, we're really keeping our eye on how fast these costs of renewables are falling. I mean, that's going to make it hard for natural gas generators to remain profitable if they keep falling like they are. We're also keeping our eyes on energy storage. Battery costs have been falling pretty rapidly. Those are getting deployed much more frequently, and the increased deployment of energy storage is just going to further help the renewable generation sources integrate into the grid, which again will put downward pressure on both coal, gas, and nuclear generators. So those are our big things. And then, of course, we're also very keenly watching what happens to the gas markets. How quickly are we going to start building some of these export terminals? What is the effect of exporting some of this natural gas going to have on gas prices? And then what effects is that going to have on other forms of generation?
Your point about energy storage is interesting. I've talked to people who say that's kind of one of the big challenges remaining for things like wind and solar, things that produce energy sometimes but not all the time. Are we close to solving that problem of having large enough, reliable enough batteries in effect to stabilize the supply of wind and solar power?
Yeah, I think we're getting closer. I don't want to speculate exactly when we'll get there, but we have seen massive growth in the storage industry in terms of capacity installed over the last few years. Part of this is driven by policies like the mandates in California and certain market aspects in the PJM market, which is the sort of mid-Atlantic electricity market. But yeah, those technologies, I think, are not quite the pie-in-the-sky type of technology that maybe they were a decade ago, and I think that wide-scale deployment is not too far off in the future.
Harrison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Harrison Fell is an associate professor at North Carolina State University in the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics, with us to talk about the EPA's plan to lift emission standards for new coal power plants.